The dog wasn't coming. Knew Joe would have found his mess and ashamed of it, probably. Cujo was a bright dog, as dogs went, and knowing or guessing such a thing was by no means out of his mental reach. Joe got a shovel and cleaned up the mess. He spilled a capful of the industrial cleaner he kept handy on the spot, mopped it, and rinsed it off with a bucket of water from the faucet at the back of the garage. That done, he got out the small spiral notebook in which he kept his work schedule and looked it over. Richie's international harvester was taken care of. That chainfall surely did take the ouch out of pulling a motor. He had pushed the transmission job back with no trouble. The teacher had been every bit as easygoing as Joe had expected. He had another half a dozen jobs lined up, all of them minor. He went into the house. He had never bothered to have a phone installed in his garage. "They charged you dear for that extra line," he had told Charity, and began to call people and tell them he would be out of town for a few days on business. He would get to most of them before they got around to taking their problems somewhere else. And if one or two couldn't wait to get their new fan belt or radiator hose, piss on 'em. The calls made, he went back out to the barn. The last item before he was free was an oil change and a ring job. The owner had promised to come by and pick up his car by noon. Joe got to work, thinking how quiet the home place seemed with Charity and Brett gone. And with Cujo gone. Usually the big St. Bernard would lie in the patch of shade by the big sliding garage door, panting, watching Joe as he worked. Sometimes Joe would talk to him, and Cujo always looked as if he was listening carefully. "Been deserted," he thought semi-resentfully. "Been deserted by all three." He glanced at the spot where Cujo had messed and shook his head again in a puzzled sort of disgust. The question of what he was going to do about feeding the dog recurred to him, and he came up empty again. Well, later on he would give the old pervert a call. Maybe he would be able to think of someone, some kid who would be willing to come up and give Cujo his chow for a couple 3 days. He nodded his head and turned the radio on to WOXO in Norway, turning it up loud. He didn't really hear it unless the news or the ball scores were on, but it was company, especially with everyone gone. He got to work. And when the phone in the house rang a dozen or so times, he never heard it. Tad Trenton was in his room at mid-morning, playing with his trucks. He had accumulated better than 30 of them in his 4 years on the earth, an extensive collection which ranged from the 79-cent plastic jobs that his dad sometimes bought him at the Bridgeton Pharmacy, where he always got Time magazine on Wednesday evenings. You had to play carefully with the 75-cent trucks, because they were made in Taiwan and had a tendency to fall apart, to the flagship of his line, a great yellow Tonka bulldozer that came up to his knees when he was standing. He had various men to stick into the cabs of his trucks. Some of them were round-headed guys scrounged from his play school toys. Others were soldiers. Not a few were what he called Star Wars guys. These included Luke, Han Solo, the Imperial Creep, a.k.a. Darth Vader, a Bespin warrior, and Tad's absolute favorite, Greedo. Greedo always got to drive the Tonka dozer. Sometimes he played Dukes of Hazzard with his trucks, sometimes BJ and the Bear, sometimes cops and moonshiners. His dad and mom had taken him to see White Lightning and White Line Fever on a double bill at the Norway drive-in, and Tad had been very impressed. Sometimes a game he had made up himself. That one was called 10 Truck Wipeout. But the game he played most often, and the one he was playing now, had no name. It consisted of digging the trucks and the men out of his two play chests and lining the trucks up one by one in diagonal parallels, the men inside, as if they were all slant parked on a street that only Tad could see. Then he would run them to the other side of the room one by one, very slowly, and line them up on that side, bumper to bumper. Sometimes he would repeat this cycle 10 or 15 times for an hour or more without tiring. Both Vic and Donna had been struck by this game. It was a little disturbing to watch Tad set up this constantly repeating, almost ritualistic pattern. They had both asked him on occasion what the attraction was, but Tad did not have the vocabulary to explain. Dukes of Hazzard, Cops and Moonshiners, and 10-Truck Wipeout were simple crash-and-bash games. The no-name game was quiet, peaceful, tranquil, ordered. If his vocabulary had been big enough, he might have told his parents it was his way of saying om, and thereby opening the doors to contemplation and reflection. Now, as he played it, he was thinking something was wrong. His eyes went automatically, unconsciously, to the door of his closet. But the problem wasn't there. The door was firmly latched, and since the monster words, it never came open. No, the something wrong was something else. He didn't know exactly what it was and wasn't sure he even wanted to know. But, like Brett Camber, he was already adept at reading the currents of the parental river upon which he floated. Just lately, he had gotten the feeling that there were black eddies, sandbars, maybe deadfalls hidden just below the surface. There could be rapids, a waterfall, anything. Things weren't right between his mother and father. It was in the way they looked at each other, the way they talked to each other. It was on their faces and behind their faces, in their thoughts. He finished changing a slant-parked row of trucks on one side of the room to bumper-to-bumper traffic on the other side and got up and went to the window. His knees hurt a little because he had been playing the no-name game for quite a while. Down below in the backyard, his mother was hanging out clothes. Half an hour earlier, she had tried to call the man who could fix the Pinto, but the man wasn't home. She waited a long time for someone to say hello and then slammed the phone down, mad. And his mom hardly ever got mad at little things like that. As he watched, she finished hanging the last two sheets. She looked at them, and her shoulders kind of sagged. She went to stand by the apple tree beyond the double clothesline, and Tad knew from her posture, her legs spread, her head down, her shoulders in slight motion, that she was crying. He watched her for a little while and then crept back to his trucks. There was a hollow place in the pit of his stomach. He missed his father already, missed him badly. But this was worse. He ran the truck slowly back across the room, one by one, returning them to their slant-parked row. He paused once when the screen door slammed. He thought she would call to him, but she didn't. There was the sound of her steps crossing the kitchen, then the creak of her special chair in the living room as she sat down. But the TV didn't go on. He thought of her just sitting down there, just sitting, and dismissed the thought quickly from his mind. He finished the row of trucks. There was Greedo, his best, sitting in the cab of the dozer, looking blankly out of his round black eyes at the door of Tad's closet. His eyes were wide, as if he had seen something there, something so scary it had shocked his eyes wide, something really gooshy, something horrible, something that was coming. Tad glanced nervously at the closet door. It was firmly latched. Still, he was tired of the game. He put the trucks back in his play chest, clanking them loudly on purpose so she would know he was getting ready to come down and watch Gunsmoke on Channel 8. He started for the door and then paused, looking at the monster words, fascinated. "Monsters, stay out of this room. You have no business here." He knew them by heart. He liked to look at them, read them by rote, look at his daddy's printing. "Nothing will touch Tad or hurt Tad all this night. You have no business here." On a sudden, powerful impulse, he pulled out the pushpin that held the paper to the wall. He took the monster words carefully, almost reverently down. He folded the sheet of paper up and put it carefully in the back pocket of his jeans. Then, feeling better than he had all day, he ran down the stairs to watch Marshall Dillon and Festus. That last fellow had come and picked up his car at 12:10. He had paid cash, which Joe had tucked away into his old greasy wallet, reminding himself to go down to the Norway Savings and pick up another 500 before he and Gary took off. Thinking of taking off made him remember Cujo and the problem of who was going to feed him. He got into his Ford wagon and drove to Gary Pervier's at the foot of the hill. He parked in Gary's driveway. He started up the porch steps, and the hail that had been rising in his throat died there. He went back and bent over the steps. There was blood there. Joe touched it with his fingers. It was tacky, but not completely dry. He stood up again, a little worried, but not yet unduly so. Gary might have been drunk and stumbled with a glass in his hand. He wasn't really worried until he saw the way the rusty bottom panel of the screen door was crashed in. Gary? There was no answer. He found himself wondering if someone with a grudge had maybe come hunting old Gary, or maybe some tourist had come asking directions and Gary had picked the wrong day to tell someone he could take a flying fuck at the moon. He climbed the steps. There were more splatters of blood on the boards of the porch. Gary? He called again, and suddenly wished for the weight of his shotgun cradled over his right arm. But if someone had punched Gary out, bloodied his nose, or maybe popped out a few of the old pervert's remaining teeth, that person was gone now, because the only car in the yard other than Joe's rusty Ford LTD wagon was Gary's white 66 Chrysler hardtop. And you just didn't walk out to town road number 3. Gary Pervier's was 7 miles from town, 2 miles off the maple sugar road that led back to Route 117. More likely he just cut himself, Joe thought. But Christ, I hope it was just his hand he cut and not his throat. Joe opened the screen door. It squealed on its hinges. Gary? Still no answer. There was a sickish, sweet smell in here that he didn't like, but at first he thought it was the honeysuckle. The stairs to the second floor went up on his left. Straight ahead was the hall to the kitchen, the living room doorway opening off the hall about halfway down on the right. There was something on the hall floor, but it was too dark for Joe to make it out. Looked like an end table that had been knocked over, or something like that. But so far as Joe knew, there wasn't now and never had been any furniture in Gary's front hall. He leaned his lawn chairs in here when it rained, but there hadn't been any rain for 2 weeks. Besides, the chairs had been out by Gary's Chrysler in their accustomed places, by the honeysuckle. Only that smell wasn't honeysuckle. It was blood, a whole lot of blood. And that was no tipped-over end table. Joe hurried down to the shape, his heart hammering in his ears. He knelt by it, and a sound like a squeak escaped his throat. Suddenly, the air in the hall seemed too hot and close. It seemed to be strangling him. He turned away from Gary, one hand cupped over his mouth. Someone had murdered Gary. Someone had... He forced himself to look back. Gary lay in a pool of his own blood. His eyes glared sightlessly up at the hallway ceiling. His throat had been opened. Not just opened, dear God. It looked as if it had been chewed open. This time there was no struggle with his gorge. This time he simply let everything come up in a series of hopeless choking sounds. Crazily, the back of his mind had turned to Charity with childish resentment. Charity had gotten her trip, but he wasn't going to get his. He wasn't going to get his because some crazy bastard had done a Jack the Ripper act on poor old Gary Pervier, and he had to call the police. Never mind all the rest of it. Never mind the way the old pervert's eyes were glaring up at the ceiling in the shadows, the way the sheared copper smell of his blood mingled with the sickish, sweet aroma of the honeysuckle. He got to his feet and staggered down toward the kitchen. He was moaning deep in his throat, but was hardly aware of it. The phone was on the wall in the kitchen. He had to call the state police, Sheriff Bannerman, someone. He stopped in the doorway. His eyes widened until they actually seemed to be bulging from his head. There was a pile of dog droppings in the doorway to the kitchen, and he knew from the size of the pile whose dog had been here.
"Cujo," he whispered. "Oh my God, Cujo's gone rabid."
He thought he heard a sound behind him, and he whirled around, hair freezing up from the back of his neck. The hallway was empty except for Gary. Gary, who had said the other night that Joe couldn't sic Cujo on a yelling nigger. Gary, with his throat laid open all the way to the knob of his backbone. There was no sense taking chances. He bolted back down the hallway, skidding momentarily in Gary's blood, leaving an elongated footmark behind him. He moaned again, but when he had shut the heavy inner door, he felt a little better. He went back to the kitchen, shying his way around Gary's body, and looked in, ready to pull the kitchen hallway door shut quickly if Cujo was in there. Again, he wished distractedly for the comforting weight of his shotgun over his arm. The kitchen was empty. Nothing moved except the curtains, stirring in a sluggish breeze which whispered through the open windows. There was the smell of dead vodka bottles. It was sour, but better than that other smell. Sunlight lay on the faded, hilly linoleum in orderly patterns. The phone, its once white plastic case now dulled with the grease of many bachelor meals and cracked in some long-ago drunken stumble, hung on the wall as always. Joe went in and closed the door firmly behind him. He crossed to the two open windows and saw nothing in the tangle of the backyard except the rusting corpses of the two cars that had predated Gary's Chrysler. He closed the windows anyway. He went to the telephone, pouring sweat in the explosively hot kitchen. The book was hanging beside the phone on a hank of hay rope. Gary had made the hole through the book where the hay rope was threaded with Joe's drill punch about a year ago, drunk as a lord and proclaiming that he didn't give a shit. Joe picked the book up and then dropped it. The book thudded against the wall. His hands felt too heavy. His mouth was slimy with the taste of vomit. He got hold of the book again and opened it with a jerk that nearly tore off the cover. He could have dialed 0 or 555-1212, but in his shock he never thought of it. The sound of his rapid, shallow breathing, his racing heart, and the riffle of the thin phone book pages masked a faint noise from behind him. The low creak of the cellar door as Cujo nosed it open. He had gone down to the cellar after killing Gary Pervier. The light in the kitchen had been too bright, too dazzling. It sent white-hot shards of agony into his decomposing brain. The cellar door had been ajar, and he had padded jerkily down the stairs into the blessedly cool dark. He had fallen asleep next to Gary's old army footlocker, and the breeze from the open windows had swung the cellar door most of the way closed. The breeze had not been quite strong enough to latch the door. The moans, the sound of Joe retching, the thumpings and slammings as Joe ran down the hall to close the front door, these things had awakened him to his pain again. His pain and his dull, ceaseless fury. Now he stood behind Joe in the dark doorway. His head was lowered. His eyes were nearly scarlet. His thick, tawny fur was matted with gore and drying mud. Foam drizzled from his mouth in a lather, and his teeth showed constantly because his tongue was beginning to swell. Joe had found the Castle Rock section of the book. He got the C's and ran a shaking finger down to Castle Rock Municipal Services in a boxed-off section halfway down one column. There was the number for the sheriff's office. He reached up a finger to begin dialing, and that was when Cujo began to growl deep in his chest. All the nerves seemed to run out of Joe Camber's body. The telephone book slithered from his fingers and thudded against the wall again. He turned slowly toward that growling sound. He saw Cujo standing in the cellar doorway.
"Nice doggy," he whispered huskily, and spit ran down his chin.
He made helpless water in his pants, and the sharp ammoniac reek of it struck Cujo's nose like a keen slap. He sprang. Joe lurched to one side on legs that felt like stilts, and the dog struck the wall hard enough to punch through the wallpaper and knock out plaster dust in a white, gritty puff. Now the dog wasn't growling. A series of heavy, grinding sounds escaped him, sounds more savage than any barks. Joe backed toward the rear door, his feet tangled in one of the kitchen chairs. He pinwheeled his arms madly for balance and might have gotten it back, but before that could happen, Cujo bore down on him, a blood-streaked killing machine with strings of foam flying backward from his jaws. There was a green, swampy stench about him.
"Oh my God, lay off'n me!" Joe Camber shrieked.
He remembered Gary. He covered his throat with one hand and tried to grapple with Cujo with the other. Cujo backed off momentarily, snapping, his muzzle wrinkled back in a great humorless grin that showed teeth like a row of slightly yellowed fence spikes. Then he came again. And this time he came for Joe Camber's balls. "Hey, kiddo, you want to come grocery shopping with me and have lunch at Mario's?" Tad got up.
"Yeah, good."
"Come on, then." She had her bag over her shoulder, and she was wearing jeans and a faded blue shirt. Tad thought she was looking very pretty. He was relieved to see there was no sign of her tears, because when she cried, he cried. He knew it was a baby thing to do, but he couldn't help it. He was halfway to the car, and she was slipping behind the wheel when he remembered that her Pinto was all screwed up.
"Mommy?"
"What?
Get in."
But he hung back a little, afraid.
"What if the car goes kerflooey?"
"Ker—" She was looking at him, puzzled. And then he saw by her exasperated expression that she had forgotten all about the car being screwed up. He had reminded her, and now she was unhappy again. Was it the Pinto's fault, or was it his? He didn't know, but the guilty feeling inside said it was his. Then her face smoothed out, and she gave him a crooked little smile that he knew well enough to feel it was his special smile, the one she saved just for him. He felt better.
"We're just going into town, Tatter. If Mom's old blue Pinto packs it in, we'll just have to blow $2 on Castle Rock's one and only taxi getting back home. Right?"
"Oh, okay." He got in and managed to pull the door shut. She watched him closely, ready to move at an instant, and Tad supposed she was thinking about last Christmas when he had shut the door on his foot and had to wear an ace bandage for about a month. But he had been just a baby then, and now he was 4 years old. Now he was a big boy. He knew that was true because his dad had told him. He smiled at his mother to show her the door had been no problem, and she smiled back. "Did it latch tight?"
"Tight,"
Tad agreed.
So she opened it and slammed it again, because moms didn't believe you unless you told them something bad, like you spilled the bag of sugar reaching for the peanut butter, or broke a window while trying to throw a rock all the way over the garage roof. "Hook your belt," she said, getting in herself again. "When that needle, valve, or whatever it is, messes up, the car jerks a lot." A little apprehensively, Tad buckled his seatbelt and harness. He sure hoped they weren't going to have an accident, like in 10-truck wipeout. Even more than that, he hoped Mom wouldn't cry. "Flaps down?" she asked, adjusting invisible goggles. "Flaps down," he agreed, grinning. It was just a game they played. "Runway clear?"
"Clear."
"Then here we go." She keyed the ignition and backed down the driveway. A moment later, they were headed for town. After about a mile, they both relaxed. Up to that point, Donna had been sitting bolt upright behind the wheel, and Tad had been doing the same in the passenger bucket. But the Pinto ran so smoothly that it might have popped off the assembly line only yesterday. They went to the Agway Market, and Donna bought $40 worth of groceries, enough to keep them the 10 days that Vic would be gone. Tad insisted on a fresh box of Twinkles, and would have added Cocoa Bears if Donna had let him. They got shipments of the Sharp cereals regularly, but they were currently out. It was a busy trip, but she still had time for bitter reflection as she waited in the checkout lane. Tad sat in the cart's child seat, swinging his legs nonchalantly. On how much 3 lousy bags of groceries went for these days. It wasn't just depressing. It was scary. That thought led her to the frightening possibility, probability, her mind whispered, that Vic and Roger might actually lose the Sharp account, and as a result of that, the agency itself. What price groceries then? She watched a fat woman with a lumpy behind, packed into avocado-colored slacks, pull a food stamp booklet out of her purse, saw the checkout girl roll her eyes at the girl running the next register, and felt the sharp rat teeth of panic gnawing at her belly. It couldn't come to that, could it? Could it? No, of course not. Of course not. They would go back to New York first. They would... She didn't like the way her thoughts were speeding up, and she pushed the whole mess resolutely away before it could grow to avalanche size and bury her in another deep depression. Next time she wouldn't have to buy coffee, and that would knock $3 off the bill. She trundled Tad and the groceries out to the Pinto and put the bags into the hatchback and Tad into the passenger bucket, standing there and listening to make sure the door latched, wanting to close the door herself, but understanding it was something he felt he had to do. It was a big boy thing. She had almost had a heart attack last December when Tad shut his foot in the door. How he had screamed! She had nearly fainted. And then Vic had been there, charging out of the house in his bathrobe, splashing out fans of driveway slush with his bare feet, and she had let him take over and be competent, which she hardly ever was in emergencies. She usually just turned to mush. He had checked to make sure the foot wasn't broken, then had changed quickly and driven them to the emergency room at the Bridgeton Hospital. Groceries stowed, likewise Tad, she got behind the wheel and started the Pinto. Now it'll fuck up, she thought. But the Pinto took them docilely up the street to Mario's, which purveyed delicious pizza stuffed with enough calories to put a spare tire on a lumberjack. She did a passable job of parallel parking, ending up only 18 inches or so from the curb, and took Tad in, feeling better than she had all day. Maybe Vic had been wrong. Maybe it had been bad gas or dirt in the fuel line, and it had finally worked its way out of the car's system. She hadn't looked forward to going out to Joe Camber's garage. It was too far out in the boonies, what Vic always referred to with high good humor as East Galosh's Corners. But, of course, he could afford high good humor. He was a man.
and she had been a little scared of Camber the one time she had met him. He was the quintessential backcountry Yankee, grunting instead of talking, sullen-faced. And the dog, what was his name? Something that sounded Spanish. Cujo, that was it. The same name William Wolfe of the SLA had taken, although Donna found it impossible to believe that Joe Camber had named his St. Bernard after a radical robber of banks and kidnapper of rich young heiresses. She doubted if Joe Camber had ever heard of the Symbionese Liberation Army. The dog had seemed friendly enough, but it had made her nervous to see Tad patting that monster, the way it made her nervous to stand by and watch him close the car door himself. Cujo looked big enough to swallow the likes of Tad in two bites. She ordered Tad a hot pastrami sandwich because he didn't care much for pizza. Kid sure didn't get that from my side of the family, she thought, and a pepperoni and onion pizza with double cheese for herself. They ate at one of the tables overlooking the road. My breath will be fit to knock over a horse, she thought, and then realized it didn't matter. She had managed to alienate both her husband and the guy who came to visit in the course of the last 6 weeks or so. That brought depression cruising her way again, and once again she forced it back. But her arms were getting a little tired. They were almost home, and Springsteen was on the radio when the Pinto started doing it again. At first, there was a small jerk. That was followed by a bigger one. She began to pump the accelerator gently. Sometimes that helped. "Mommy?" Tad asked, alarmed. "It's all right, Tad," she said. But it wasn't. The Pinto began to jerk hard, throwing them both against their seat belts with enough force to lock the harness clasps. The engine chopped and roared. A bag fell over in the hatchback compartment, spilling cans and bottles. She heard something break. "You goddamn shitting thing!" she cried in an exasperated fury. She could see their house just below the brow of the hill, mockingly close, but she didn't think the Pinto was going to get them there. Frightened as much by her shout as by the car's spasms, Tad began to cry, adding to her confusion and upset and anger. "Shut up!" she yelled at him. "Oh, Christ, just shut up, Tad!" He began to cry harder, and his hand went to the bulge in his back pocket where the monster words, folded up to packet size, were stowed away. Touching them made him feel a little bit better. Not much, but a little. Donna decided she was going to have to pull over and stop. There was nothing else for it. She began to steer toward the shoulder, using the last of her forward motion to get there. They could use Tad's wagon to pull the groceries up to the house and then decide what to do about the Pinto. Maybe. Just as the Pinto's offside wheels crunched over the sandy gravel at the edge of the road, the engine backfired twice, and then the jerks smoothed out as they had done on previous occasions. A moment later, she was scooting up to the driveway of the house and turning in. She drove uphill, shifted to park, pulled the emergency brake, turned off the motor, leaned over the wheel, and cried.
"Mommy," Tad said miserably. "Don't cry no more," he tried to add, but he had no voice, and he could only mouth the words soundlessly, as if struck dumb by laryngitis. He looked at her only, wanting to comfort, not knowing just how it was done. Comforting her was Daddy's job, not his. And suddenly he hated his father for being somewhere else. The depth of this emotion both shocked and frightened him, and for no reason at all, he suddenly saw his closet door coming open and spilling out a darkness that stank of something low and bitter. At last she looked up, her face puffy. She found a handkerchief in her purse and wiped her eyes. "I'm sorry, honey. I wasn't really shouting at you. I was shouting at this thing.
she struck the steering wheel with her hand, hard.
Ow!
She put the edge of her hand in her mouth and then laughed a little. It wasn't a happy laugh.
Guess it's still kerflooey,
Tad said glumly.
I guess it is, she agreed, almost unbearably lonesome for Vic.
Well, let's get the things in. We've got the supplies anyway, Cisco.
Right, Poncho, he said. I'll get my wagon.
He brought his Red Ball flyer down, and Donna loaded the three bags into it after repacking the bag that had fallen over. It had been a ketchup bottle that had shattered. You'd figure it, wouldn't you? Half a bottle of Heinz had puddled out on the powder blue pile carpeting of the hatchback. It looked as if someone had committed harakiri back there. She supposed she could sop up the worst of it with a sponge, but the stain would still show. Even if she used a rug shampoo, she was afraid it would show. She tugged the wagon up to the kitchen door at the side of the house while Tad pushed. She lugged the groceries in and was debating whether to put them away or clean up the ketchup before it could set when the phone rang. Tad was off for it like a sprinter at the sound of a gun. He had gotten very good at answering the phone.
Yes, who is it, please?
He listened, grinned, then held out the phone to her. Figures, she thought. Someone who'll want to talk for 2 hours about nothing. To Tad, she said,
Do you know who it is, hun?
Sure, he said. It's Dad. Her heart began to beat more rapidly. She took the phone from Tad and said, Hello, Vic?
Hi, Donna.
It was his voice, all right, but so reserved, so careful. It gave her a deep sinking feeling that she didn't need on top of everything else. Are you all right? She asked.
Sure.
I just thought you'd call later, if at all.
Well, we went right over to Image Eye. They did all the sharp serial, Professor Spots, and what do you think? They can't find the frigging kinescopes. Roger's ripping his hair out by the roots.
Yes, she said, nodding. He hates to be off schedule, doesn't he?
That's an understatement.
He sighed deeply.
So I just thought, while they were looking.
He trailed off vaguely, and her feelings of desperation, her feelings of sinking, feelings that were so unpleasant and yet so childishly passive, turned to a more active sense of fear. Vic never trailed off like that, not even if he was being distracted by stuff going on at his end of the wire. She thought of the way he had looked on Thursday night, so ragged and close to the edge. Vic, are you all right? She could hear the alarm in her voice and knew he must hear it too. Even Tad looked up from the coloring book with which he had sprawled out on the hall floor, his eyes bright, a tight little frown on his small forehead.
Yeah, he said. I just started to say that I thought I'd call now, while they're rummaging around. Won't have a chance later tonight, I guess. How's Tad?
Tad's fine. She smiled at Tad and then tipped him a wink. Tad smiled back, the lines on his forehead smoothed out, and he went back to his coloring. He sounds tired, and I'm not going to lay all that shit about the car on him, she thought, and then found herself going right ahead and doing it anyway. She heard the familiar whine of self-pity creeping into her voice and struggled to keep it out. Why was she even telling him all of this, for heaven's sake? He sounded like he was falling apart, and she was prattling on about her Pinto's carburetor and a spilled bottle of ketchup.
Yeah, it sounds like that needle valve okay, Vic said.
He actually sounded a little better now, a little less down. Maybe because it was a problem which mattered so little in the greater perspective of things which they had now been forced to deal with.
Couldn't Joe Camber get you in today?
I tried him, but he wasn't home.
He probably was, though, Vic said. There's no phone in his garage. Usually his wife or his kid runs his messages out to him. Probably they were out someplace.
Well, he still might be gone.
Sure, Vic said. But I really doubt it, babe. If a human being could actually put down roots, Joe Camber's the guy that would do it.
Should I just take a chance and drive out there?
Donna asked doubtfully. She was thinking of the empty miles along 117 and the Maple Sugar Road, and all that was before you got to Camber's Road, which was so far out it didn't even have a name. And if that needle valve chose a stretch of that desolation in which to pack up for good, it would just make another hassle.
No, I guess you better not, Vic said. He's probably there, unless you really need him, in which case he'd be gone. Catch 22.
He sounded depressed.
Then what should I do?
Call the Ford dealership and tell them you want a tow.
But
no, you have to. If you try to drive 22 miles over to South Paris, it'll pack up on you for sure. And if you explain the situation in advance, they might be able to get you a loaner. Barring that, they'll lease you a car.
Lease?
Vic, isn't that expensive?
Yeah,
he said.
She thought again that it was wrong of her to be dumping all this on him. He was probably thinking that she wasn't capable of anything, except maybe screwing the local furniture refinisher. She was fine at that.
Hot salt tears, partly anger, partly self-pity, stung her eyes again.
I'll take care of it, she said, striving desperately to keep her voice normal, light. Her elbow was propped on the wall and one hand was over her eyes. Not to worry.
Well, I... Oh, shit, there's Roger. He's dust up to his neck, but they got the kinescopes. Put Tad on for a second, would you?
Frantic questions backed up in her throat. Was it all right? Did he think it could be all right? Could they get back to go and start again?
Too late. No time.
She had spent the time gabbing about the car.
Dumb broad, stupid quiff.
Sure, she said. He'll say goodbye for both of us.
And Vic?
What?
He sounded impatient now, pressed for time.
I love you, she said. And then before he could reply, she added, Here's Tad.
She gave the phone to Tad quickly, almost conking him on the head with it, and went through the house to the front porch, stumbling over a hassock and sending it spinning, seeing everything through a prism of tears. She stood on the porch looking out at 117, clutching her elbows, struggling to get herself under control. Control, damn it, control!
And it was amazing, wasn't it, how bad you could hurt when there was nothing physically wrong.
Behind her, she could hear the soft murmur of Tad's voice, telling Vic they had eaten at Mario's, that Mommy had her favorite fat pizza, and the Pinto had been okay until they were almost home. Then he was telling Vic that he loved him. Then there was the soft sound of the phone being hung up. Contact broken.
Control.
At last, she felt as if she had some. She went back into the kitchen and began putting away the groceries. Charity Camber stepped down from the Greyhound bus at 3:15 that afternoon. Brett was right at her heels. She was clutching the strap of her purse spasmodically. She was suddenly, irrationally afraid that she would not recognize Holly. Her sister's face held in her mind like a photograph all these years, the younger sister who had married well, had gone suddenly and mysteriously out of her mind, leaving only a fogged blank where the picture should have been.
You see her? Brett asked as they alighted. He looked around at the Stratford bus depot with bright interest and no more.
There was certainly no fear in his face.
Give me a chance to look around, Charity said sharply. Probably she's in the coffee shop or...
Charity?
She turned, and there was Holly. The picture held in her memory came flooding back, but it was now a transparency overlying the real face of the woman standing by the Space Invaders game. Charity's first thought was that Holly was wearing glasses. How funny. Her second, shocked, was that Holly had wrinkles. Not many, but there could be no question about what they were. Her third thought was not precisely a thought at all. It was an image as clear, true, and heartbreaking as a sepia-toned photograph. Holly leaping into Old Man Seltzer's cow pond in her underpants, pigtails standing up against the sky, thumb and forefinger of her left hand pinching her nostrils closed for comic effect. No glasses then, Charity thought, and pain came to her then, and it squeezed her heart. Standing at Holly's sides, looking shyly at her and Brett, were a boy of about 5 and a girl who was perhaps 2 and a half. The little girl's bulgy pants spoke of diapers beneath. Her stroller stood off to one side.
Hi, Holly, Charity said, and her voice was so thin she could hardly hear it.
The wrinkles were small. They turned upward, the way their mother had always said the good ones did. Her dress was dark blue, moderately expensive. The pendant she wore was either a very good piece of costume jewelry or a very small emerald. There was a moment then, some space of time. In it, Charity felt her heart fill with a joy so fierce and complete that she knew there could never be any real question about what this trip had or had not cost her. For now, she was free. Her son was free. This was her sister, and those children were her kin, not pictures, but real. Laughing and crying a little, the two women stepped toward each other, hesitantly at first, then quickly. They embraced. Brett stood where he was. The little girl, maybe scared, went to her mother and wrapped a hand firmly around the hem of her dress, perhaps to keep her mother and this strange lady from flying off together. The little boy stared at Brett, then advanced. He was wearing tough-skin jeans and a T-shirt with the words, "Here Comes Trouble," printed on it.
"You're my cousin Brett," the kid said.
"Yeah.
My name's Jim, just like my dad."
Yeah.
You're from Maine, Jim said.
Behind him, Charity and Holly were talking rapidly, interrupting each other and laughing at their hurry to tell everything right here in this grimy bus station south of Milford and north of Bridgeport.
Yeah, I'm from Maine, Brett said.
You're 10.
Right.
I'm 5.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I can beat you up.
Coward!
He hit Brett in the belly, doubling him up. Brett uttered a large and surprised oof. Both women gasped.
Jimmy, Holly cried in a kind of resigned horror.
Brett straightened up slowly and saw his mother watching him, her face in a kind of suspension.
Yeah, you can beat me up any time, Brett said, and smiled.
And it was all right. He saw from his mother's face that it was all right, and he was glad. By 3:30, Donna had decided to leave Tad with a babysitter and try taking the Pinto up to Camber's. She had tried the number again, and there had still been no response, but she had reasoned that even if Camber wasn't in his garage, he would be back soon, maybe even by the time she arrived there, always assuming she did arrive there. Vic told her last week that Camber would probably have some old junker to loan her if it looked like her Pinto was going to be an overnight job. That had really been the deciding factor. But she thought that taking Tad would be wrong.
If the Pinto seized up on that back road and she had to take a hike, well, okay, but Tad shouldn't have to do it. Tad, however, had other ideas. Shortly after talking to his dad, he had gone up to his room and had stretched out on his bed with a stack of little golden books. 15 minutes later, he had dozed off, and a dream had come to him. A dream which seemed utterly ordinary, but which had a strange, nearly terrifying power. In this dream, he saw a big boy throwing a friction-taped baseball up and trying to hit it. He missed twice, three times, four. On the fifth swing, he hit the ball, and the bat, which had also been taped, shattered at the handle. The boy held the handle for a moment, black tape flapped from it, then bent and picked up the fat of the bat. He looked at it for a moment, shook his head disgustedly, and tossed it into the high grass at the side of the driveway. Then he turned, and Tad saw with a sudden shock that was half dread, half delight, that the boy was himself at 10 or 11. Yes, it was him. He was sure of it. Then the boy was gone, and there was a grayness. In it he could hear two sounds, creaking swing chains and the faint quacking of ducks. With these sounds and the grayness came a sudden scary feeling that he could not breathe. He was suffocating. And a man was walking out of the mist. A man who wore a black shiny raincoat and held a stop sign on a stick in one hand. He grinned, and his eyes were shiny silver coins. He raised one hand to point at Tad, and he saw with horror it wasn't a hand at all. It was bones, and the face inside the shiny vinyl hood of the raincoat wasn't a face at all. It was a skull. It was... He jerked awake, his body bathed in sweat that was only in part due to the room's explosive heat. He sat up, propped on his elbows, breathing in harsh gasps. Snick! The closet door was swinging open, and as it swung open, he saw something inside, only for a second. And then he was flying for the door which gave on the hall as fast as he could. He saw it only for a second, long enough to tell it wasn't the man in the shiny black raincoat, Frank Dodd, the man who had killed the ladies. Not him. Something else. Something with red eyes, like bloody sunsets. But he could not speak of these things to his mother, so he concentrated on Debbie, the sitter, instead. He didn't want to be left with Debbie. Debbie was mean to him. She always played the record player loud, etc., etc. When none of this had much effect on his mother, Tad suggested ominously that Debbie might shoot him. When Donna made the mistake of giggling helplessly at the thought of 15-year-old myopic Debbie Geringer shooting anyone, Tad burst into miserable tears and ran into the living room. He needed to tell her that Debbie Geringer might not be strong enough to keep the monster in his closet, that if dark fell and his mother was not back, it might come out. It might be the man in the black raincoat, or it might be the beast. Donna followed him, sorry for her laughter, wondering how she could have been so insensitive. The boy's father was gone, and that was upsetting enough. He didn't want to lose sight of his mother for even an hour. And isn't it possible he senses some of what's going on between Vic and me? Perhaps even heard. No, she didn't think that. She couldn't think that. It was just the upset of his routine. The door to the living room was shut. She reached for the knob, hesitated, then knocked softly instead. There was no answer. She knocked again, and when there was still no answer, she went in quietly. Tad was lying face down on the couch with one of the back cushions pulled firmly down over his head. It was behavior reserved only for major upsets. Tad? No answer. I'm sorry, I laughed.
His face looked out at her from beneath one edge of the puffy, dove-gray sofa cushion. There were fresh tears on his face.
"Please, can't I come?"
he asked.
"Don't make me stay here with Debbie, Mom."
Great histrionics, she thought. Great histrionics and blatant coercion. She recognized it, or felt she did, and at the same time found it impossible to be tough, partly because her own tears were threatening again. Lately it seemed that there was always a cloudburst just over the horizon.
"Honey, you know the way the Pinto was when we came back from town. It could break down in the middle of East Galoshes Corners, and we'd have to walk to a house and use the telephone, maybe a long way."
"So, I'm a good walker."
"I know, but you might get scared."
Thinking of the thing in the closet, Tad suddenly cried out with all his force,
"I will not get scared!"
His hand had gone automatically to the bulge in the hip pocket of his jeans, where the monster words were stowed away.
"Don't raise your voice that way, please. It sounds ugly."
He lowered his voice.
"I won't get scared. I just want to go with you."
She looked at him helplessly, knowing that she really ought to call Debbie Gehringer, feeling that she was being shamelessly manipulated by her 4-year-old son. And if she gave in, it would be for all the wrong reasons. She thought helplessly, "It's like a chain reaction that doesn't stop any place, and it's gumming up works I didn't even know existed. Oh, God, I wish I was in Tahiti." She opened her mouth to tell him, quite firmly and once and for all, that she was going to call Debbie and they could make popcorn together if he was good, and that he would have to go to bed right after supper if he was bad, and that was the end of it. Instead, what came out was, "All right, you can come, but our Pinto might not make it, and if it doesn't, we'll have to walk to a house and have the town taxi come and pick us up. And if we do have to walk, I don't want to have to listen to you crabbing at me, Tad Trenton."
"No, I won't."
"Let me finish. I don't want you crabbing at me or asking me to carry you, because I won't do it. Do we have an understanding?"
"Yeah. Yeah, sure."
Tad hopped off the sofa, all grief forgotten.
"Are we going now?"
"Yes, I guess so. Or, I know what. Why don't I make us a snack first? A snack, and we'll put some milk in the thermos bottles, too. In case we have to camp out all night." Tad suddenly looked doubtful again.
"No, honey."
She smiled and gave him a little hug. "But I still haven't been able to get Mr. Camber on the telephone. Your daddy says it's probably just because he doesn't have a phone in his garage, so he doesn't know I'm calling. And his wife and little boy might be someplace, so..."
"He should have a phone in his garage," Tad said. "That's dumb."
"Just don't you tell him that," Donna said quickly, and Tad shook his head that he wouldn't. "Anyway, if nobody's there, I thought you and I could have a little snack in the car, or maybe on his steps and wait for him." Tad clapped his hands.
"Great! Great! Can I take my Snoopy lunchbox?"
"Sure," Donna said, giving in completely. She found a box of Keebler fig bars and a couple of Slim Jims. Donna thought they were hideous things, but they were Tad's all-time favorite snack. She wrapped some green olives and cucumber slices in foil. She filled Tad's thermos with milk and half-filled Vic's big thermos, the one he took on camping trips. For some reason, looking at the food made her uneasy. She looked at the phone and thought about trying Joe Camber's number again. Then she decided there was no sense in it, since they would be going out there either way. Then she thought of asking Tad again if he wouldn't rather she called Debbie Gehringer,
and then wondered what was wrong with her. Tad had made himself perfectly clear on that point. It was just that, suddenly, she didn't feel good. Not good at all. It was nothing she could put her finger on. She looked around the kitchen as if expecting the source of her unease to announce itself. It didn't.
"We going, Mom?"
"Yes," she said absently. There was a note minder on the wall by the fridge, and on this she scrawled, "Tad and I have gone out to Jay Camber's garage with Pinto. Back soon."
"Ready, Tad?"
"Sure,"
he grinned.
"Who's the note for, Mom?"
"Oh, Joni might drop by with those raspberries," she said vaguely. "Or maybe Allison McKenzie. She was going to show me some Amway and Avon stuff."
"Oh."
Donna ruffled his hair, and they went out together. The heat hit them like a hammer wrapped in pillows. "Buggeredly car probably won't even start," she thought. But it did. It was 3:45 p.m. They drove southeast along Route 117 toward the Maple Sugar Road, which was about 5 miles out of town. The Pinto behaved in exemplary fashion. And if it hadn't been for the bout of snaps and jerks coming from the shopping trip, Donna would have wondered what she had bothered making such a fuss about. But there had been that bout of the shakes, and so she drove sitting bolt upright again, going no faster than 40, pulling as far to the right as she could when a car came up behind her. And there was a lot of traffic on the road. The summer influx of tourists and vacationers had begun. The Pinto had no air conditioning, so they rode with both windows open. A Continental with New York plates towing a gigantic trailer with two mopeds on the back swung around them on a blind curve, the driver bleating his horn. The driver's wife, a fat woman wearing mirror sunglasses, looked at Donna and Tad with imperious contempt.
"Get stuffed!"
Donna yelled, and popped her middle finger up at the fat lady. The fat lady turned away quickly. Tad was looking at his mother just a little nervously, and Donna smiled at him.
"No hassle, big guy. We're going good. Just out-of-state fools."
"Oh," Tad said cautiously. "Listen to me," she thought. "The big Yankee. Vic would be proud." She had to grin at herself, because everyone in Maine understood that if you moved here from another place, you would be an out-of-stater until you were sent down in your grave. And on your tombstone they would write something like, "Harry Jones, Castle Corners, Maine, originally from Omaha, Nebraska." Most of the tourists were headed toward 302, where they would turn east to Naples or west toward Bridgeton, Fryeburg, and North Conway, New Hampshire, with its alpine slides, cut-rate amusement parks, and tax-free restaurants. Donna and Tad were not going up to the 302 junction. Although their home overlooked downtown Castle Rock with its picture-book town common, woods had closed in on both sides of the road before they were 5 miles from their own front door. These woods drew back occasionally, a little, to show a lot with a house or a trailer in it, and as they went farther out, the houses were more often of the type that her father had called shanty Irish. The sun still shone brightly down, and there was a good 4 hours of daylight left, but the emptiness made her feel uneasy again. It was not so bad here on 117, but once they left the main road. Their turnoff was marked with a sign saying Maple Sugar Road in faded, almost unreadable letters. It had been splintered considerably by kids banging away with 22s and birdshot. This road was two-lane blacktop, bumpy and frost-heaved. It wound past two or three nice houses, two or three not-so-nice houses, and one old and shabby Road King trailer sitting on a crumbling concrete foundation. There was a yard full of weeds in front of the trailer. Donna could see cheap-looking plastic toys in the weeds.
A sign nailed askew to a tree at the head of the driveway read, "Free Kittens." A pot-bellied kid of maybe 2 stood in the driveway, his sopping pamper hanging below his tiny penis. His mouth hung open, and he was picking his nose with one finger and his navel with another. Looking at him, Donna felt a helpless chill of goose flesh. "Stop it! For Christ's sake, what's wrong with you?" The woods closed in around them again. An old 68 Ford Fairlane with a lot of rust-red primer paint on the hood and around the headlights passed them going the other way. A young kid with a lot of hair was slouched nonchalantly behind the wheel. He wasn't wearing a shirt. The Fairlane was doing maybe 80. Donna winced. It was the only traffic they saw. The Maple Sugar Road climbed steadily, and when they passed the occasional field or large garden, they were afforded a stunning view of western Maine toward Bridgeton and Fryeburg. Long Lake glittered in the farthest distance like the sapphire pendant of a fabulously rich woman. They were climbing another long slope up one of these eroded hills. As advertised, the sides of the road were now lined with dusty, heat-drooping maples, when the Pinto began to buck and jolt again. Donna's breath clogged in her throat, and she thought, "Oh, come on! Oh, come on! Come on, you cruddy little car! Come on!" Tad shifted uneasily in the passenger bucket and held onto his Snoopy lunchbox a little tighter. She began to tap the accelerator lightly, her mind repeating the same words over and over like an inarticulate prayer. "Come on! Come on! Come on!" "Mommy, is it—" "Hush, Tad." The jerking grew worse. She pressed the gas pedal harder in frustration, and the Pinto squirted ahead, the engine smoothing out once more. "Yay!" Tad said so suddenly and loudly that she jumped. "We're not there yet, Tadder." A mile farther along, they came to an intersection marked with another wooden sign, this one reading Town Road Number 3. Donna turned in, feeling triumphant. As well as she remembered, Camber's place was less than a mile and a half from here. If the Pinto gave up the ghost now, she and Tad could ankle it. They passed a ramshackle house with a station wagon and a big old rusty white car in the driveway. In her rear-view mirror, Donna noticed that the honeysuckle had really gone crazy on the side of the house that would catch most of the sun. A field opened up on their left after they passed the house, and the Pinto began to climb a long, steep hill. Halfway up, the little car began to labor again. This time it was jerking harder than it ever had before.
"Will it get up, Mommy?"
"Yes," she said grimly. The Pinto's speedometer needle dropped from 40 to 30. She dropped the transmission selector lever from drive into the lower range, thinking vaguely that it might help compression or something. Instead, the Pinto began to buck worse than ever. A fusillade of backfires roared through the exhaust pipe, making Tad cry out. Now they were down to fast running speed, but she could see the camber house and the red barn that served as his garage. Flooring the accelerator had helped before. She tried it again, and for a moment, the engine smoothed out. The speedometer needle crept up from 15 to 20. Then it began to shake and shudder once more. Donna tried flooring the gas yet again, but this time, instead of smoothing out, the engine began to fail. The amp idiot light on the dashboard began to flicker dully, signaling the fact that the Pinto was now on the edge of a stall. But it didn't matter, because the Pinto was now laboring past the camber mailbox. They were here. There was a package hung over the mailbox lid, and she saw the return address clearly as they passed it, J.C. Whitney and Company. The information went directly to the back of her mind without stopping. Her immediate attention was focused on getting the car into the driveway.
Let it stall then, she thought. He'll have to fix it before he can get in or out. The driveway was a little beyond the house. If it had been an uphill driveway all the way, as the Trentons' own was, the Pinto would not have made it. But after a small initial rise, the Cambers' driveway ran either dead level or slightly downhill toward the big converted barn. Donna shifted into neutral and let what was left of the Pinto's forward motion carry them toward the big barn doors, which stood half open on their tracks. As soon as her foot left the accelerator pedal to tap the brake and stop them, the motor began to hitch again, but feebly this time. The amp light pulsed like a slow heartbeat, then brightened. The Pinto stalled. Tad looked at Donna. She grinned at him. "Tad, old buddy," she said, "we have arrived."
"Yeah," he said, "but is anybody home?"
There was a dark green pickup truck parked beside the barn. It was Camber's truck, all right, not someone else's waiting to be fixed. She remembered it from last time. But the lights were off inside. She craned her neck to the left and saw they were off in the house, too. And there had been a package hung over the mailbox lid. The return address on the package had been J.C. Whitney and Company. She knew what that was. Her brother had gotten their catalog in the mail when he was a teenager. They sold auto parts, accessories, customizing equipment. A package for Joe Camber from J.C. Whitney was the most natural thing in the world. But if he was here, he surely would have gotten his mail by now.
"Nobody home," she thought dispiritedly,
and felt a weary sort of anger at Vic. "He's always home. Sure he is. The guy would put down roots in his garage if he could. Sure he would. Except when I need him."
"Well, let's go see anyhow," she said, opening her door.
"I can't get my seatbelt unhooked," Tad said, scratching futilely at the buckle release. "Okay, don't have a hemorrhage, Tad. I'll come around and let you out." She got out, slammed her door, and took two steps toward the front of the car, intending to cross in front of the hood to the passenger side and let Tad out of his harness. It would give Camber a chance to come out and see who his company was if he was here. She somehow didn't relish poking her head in on him unannounced. It was probably foolish, but since that ugly and frightening scene with Steve Kemp in her kitchen, she had become more aware of what it was to be an unprotected woman than she had since she was 16 and her mother and father had let her begin dating. The quiet struck her at once. It was hot and so quiet that it was somehow unnerving. There were sounds, of course, but even after several years in Castle Rock, the most she could say about her ears was that they had slowly adapted from city ears to town ears. They were by no means country ears, and this was the real country. She heard birdsong and the harsher music of a crow somewhere in the long field which stretched down the flank of the hill they had just climbed. There was the sigh of a light breeze, and the oaks that lined the driveway made moving patterns of shadow around her feet. But she could not hear a single car engine, not even the faraway burp of a tractor or a baling machine. City ears and town ears are more closely attuned to man-made sounds. Those that nature makes tend to fall outside the tightly drawn net of selective perception. A total lack of such sounds makes for unease. I'd hear him if he was working in the barn, Donna thought. But the only sounds that registered were her own crunching footfalls on the crushed gravel of the driveway and a low humming sound, barely audible. With no conscious thought at all, her mind placed it as the hum of a power transformer on one of the poles back by the road.
She reached the front of the hood and started to cross in front of the Pinto. And that was when she heard a new sound. A low, thick growling. She stopped, her head coming up at once, trying to pinpoint the source of that sound. For a moment, she couldn't. And she was suddenly terrified, not by the sound itself, but by its seeming directionlessness. It was nowhere. It was everywhere. And then some internal radar, survival equipment perhaps, turned on all the way, and she understood that the growling was coming from inside the garage.
Mommy?
Tad poked his head out of his open window as far as the seatbelt harness would allow.
I can't get this damn old
shh growling. She took a tentative step backward, her right hand resting lightly on the Pinto's low hood, her nerves on tripwires as thin as filaments, not panicked, but in a state of heightened alertness, thinking, it didn't growl before. Cujo came out of Joe Camber's garage. Donna stared at him, feeling her breath come to a painless and yet complete stop in her throat. It was the same dog. It was Cujo. But, oh my! Oh my God! The dog's eyes settled on hers. They were red and rheumy. They were leaking some viscous substance. The dog seemed to be weeping gummy tears. His tawny coat was caked and matted with mud and blood. Is that? It is. It's blood. Christ. Christ. She couldn't seem to move. No breath. Dead low tide in her lungs. She had heard about being paralyzed with fear, but had never realized it could happen with such totality. There was no contact between her brain and her legs. That twisted gray filament running down the core of her spine had shut off the signals. Her hands were stupid blocks of flesh south of her wrists, with no feeling in them. Her urine went. She was unaware of it, save for some vague sensation of distant warmth. And the dog seemed to know. His terrible, thoughtless eyes never left Donna Trenton's wide blue ones. He paced forward slowly, almost languidly. Now he was standing on the barn boards at the mouth of the garage. Now he was on the crushed gravel 25 feet away. He never stopped growling. It was a low, purr sound, soothing in its menace. Foam dropped from Cujo's snout. And she couldn't move. Not at all. Then Tad saw the dog, recognized the blood which streaked its fur, and shrieked, a high piercing sound that made Cujo shift his eyes. And that was what seemed to free her. She turned in a great shambling drunk's pivot, slamming her lower leg against the Pinto's fender and sending a steely bolt of pain up to her hip. She ran back around the hood of the car. Cujo's growl rose to a shattering roar of rage, and he charged at her. Her feet almost skidded out from under her in the loose gravel, and she was only able to recover by slamming her arm down on the Pinto's hood. She hit her crazy bone and uttered a thin shriek of pain. The car door was shut. She had shut it herself automatically after getting out. The chromed button below the handle suddenly seemed dazzlingly bright, winking arrows of sun into her eyes. I'll never be able to get that door open and get in and get it shut, she thought. And the choking realization that she might be about to die rose up in her. Not enough time. No way. She raked the door open. She could hear her breath sobbing in and out of her throat. Tad screamed again, a shrill, breaking sound. She sat down, almost falling into the driver's seat.
She got a glimpse of Cujo coming at her, hindquarters tensing down for the leap that would bring all 200 pounds of him right into her lap. She yanked the Pinto's door shut with both hands, reaching over the steering wheel with her right arm, honking the horn with her shoulder. She was just in time. A split second after the door slammed closed, there was a heavy, solid thud, as if someone had swung a chunk of stove wood against the side of the car. The dog's barking roars of rage were cut off cleanly, and there was silence. "Knocked himself out," she thought hysterically. "Thank God! Thank God for that!" And a moment later, Cujo's foam-covered, twisted face popped up outside her window, only inches away, like a horror movie monster that has decided to give the audience the ultimate thrill by coming right out of the screen. She could see his huge, heavy teeth, and again there was that swooning, terrible feeling that the dog was looking at her. Not at a woman who just happened to be trapped in her car with her little boy, but at Donna Trenton, as if he had just been hanging around, waiting for her to show up. Cujo began to bark again, the sound incredibly loud, even through the safety glass, and suddenly it occurred to her that if she had not automatically rolled her window up as she brought the Pinto to a stop, something her father had insisted on, stop the car, roll up the windows, set the brake, take the keys, lock the car, she would now be minus her throat. Her blood would be on the wheel, the dash, the windshield. That one action, so automatic she could not even really remember performing it. She screamed. The dog's terrible face dropped from view. She remembered Tad and looked around. When she saw him, a new fear invaded her, drilling like a hot needle. He had not fainted, but he was not really conscious either. He had fallen back against the seat, his eyes dazed and blank. His face was white. His lips had gone bluish at the corners. "Tad?" She snapped her fingers under his nose, and he blinked sluggishly at the dry sound. "Tad!"
"Mommy," he said thickly. "How did the monster in my closet get out? Is it a dream? Is it my nap?"
"It's going to be all right," she said, chilled by what he had said about his closet nonetheless. "It's..." She saw the dog's tail and the top of its broad back over the hood of the Pinto. It was going around to Tad's side of the car. And Tad's window wasn't shut. She jackknifed across Tad's lap, moving with such a hard muscular spasm that she cracked her fingers on the window crank. She turned it as fast as she could, panting, feeling Tad squirming beneath her. It was 3/4 of the way up when Cujo leaped at the window. His muzzle shot through the closing gap and was forced upward toward the ceiling by the closing window. The sound of his snarling barks filled the small car. Tad shrieked again and wrapped his arms around his head, his forearms crossed over his eyes. He tried to dig his face into Donna's belly, reducing her leverage on the window crank in his blind efforts to get away.
"Mama! Mama! Mama! Make it stop! Make it go away!"
Something warm was running across the backs of her hands. She saw with mounting horror that it was mixed slime and blood running from the dog's mouth. Using everything that she had, she managed to force the window crank through another 1/4 turn. And then Cujo pulled back. She caught just a glimpse of the St. Bernard's features, twisted and crazy, a mad caricature of a friendly St. Bernard's face. Then it dropped back to all 4s, and she could only see its back. Now the crank turned easily. She shut the window, then wiped the backs of her hands on her jeans, uttering small cries of revulsion. "Oh, Christ! Oh, Mary, Mother of God!"
Tad had gone back to that dazed state of semi-consciousness again. This time, when she snapped her fingers in front of his face, there was no reaction.
He's going to have some complexes out of this. Oh, God, yes. Oh, sweet Tad. If only I'd left you with Debbie.
She took him by the shoulders and began to shake him gently back and forth.
Is it my nap?
He asked again. No, she said. He moaned, a low, painful sound that tore at her heart. No, but it's all right. Tad, it's okay. That dog can't get in. The windows are shut now. It can't come in. It can't get us. That got through, and Tad's eyes cleared a little.
Then let's go home, Mommy. I don't want to be here.
Yes. Yes, we'll... Like a great tawny projectile, Cujo leaped onto the hood of the Pinto and charged at the windshield, barking. Tad uttered another scream, his eyes bulging, his small hands digging at his cheeks, leaving angry red welts there.
It can't get us,
Donna shouted at him.
Do you hear me? It can't get in, Tad.
Cujo struck the windshield with a muffled thud, bounced back, and scrabbled for purchase on the hood. He left a series of new scratches on the paint. Then he came again.
I want to go home,
Tad screamed. Hug me tight, Tadder, and don't worry. How insane that sounded. But what else was there to say? Tad buried his face against her breasts just as Cujo struck the windshield again. Foam smeared against the glass as he tried to bite his way through. Those muddled, bleary eyes stared into Donna's.
I'm going to pull you to pieces, they said. You and the boy both. Just as soon as I find a way to get into this tin can, I'll eat you alive. I'll be swallowing pieces of you while you're still screaming.
Rabid, she thought. That dog is rabid. With steadily mounting fear, she looked past the dog on the hood and at Joe Camber's parked truck. Had the dog bitten him? She found the horn buttons and pressed them. The Pinto's horn blared and the dog skittered back, again almost losing its balance.
Don't like that much, do you? She shrieked triumphantly at it. Hurts your ears, doesn't it?
She jammed the horn down again. Cujo leaped off the hood.
Mommy, please, let's go home.
She turned the key in the ignition. The motor cranked and cranked and cranked. But the Pinto did not start. At last, she turned the key off again. Honey, we can't go just yet. The car...
Yes, yes, now, right now.
Her head began to thud, big whacking pains that were in perfect sync with her heartbeat. Tad, listen to me. The car doesn't want to start. It's that needle valve thing. We've got to wait until the engine cools off. It'll go then, I think. We can leave. All we have to do is get back out of the driveway and get pointed down the hill. Then it won't matter even if it does stall, because we can coast. If I don't chicken out and hit the brake, I should be able to make it most of the way back to the Maple Sugar Road, even with the engine shut down. Or... She thought of the house at the bottom of the hill, the one with the honeysuckle running wild all over the east side. There were people there. She had seen cars. People! She began to use the horn again. Three short blasts, three long blasts, three shorts, over and over, the only Morse she remembered from her 2 years in the Girl Scouts. They would hear. Even if they didn't understand the message, they would come up to see who was raising hell at Joe Camber's and why.
Where was the dog?
She couldn't see him anymore, but it didn't matter. The dog couldn't get in, and help would be here shortly. Everything's going to be fine, she told Tad. Wait and see.